Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I mean, come on. How hard can a debt limit deal really be?
Pull off the Band-Aid. Eat our peas. Now's the time to do it.
But what if you don't like peas? The president and the speaker try to win hearts and minds. Also, the five-year plan. I go back to China to see what's changed since the last time we were there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being. Online at Barron's.com. And by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as online savings account and money market account. Learn more at AllyBank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could join us on this Monday, everybody. It's the 11th of July. And what we had in the Great American Debt Limit Debate of 2011 today wasn't really substantive negotiation, wasn't really the hurly-burly of reasonable political discourse. It was, in the final analysis, a set of dueling news conferences. The president said when he went first, as he has said before, that the debt ceiling just has to be raised. The people are watching, he said. Kinda.
Yeah, the public is not paying close attention to the ins and outs of how a treasury auction goes. They shouldn't. They're worrying about their family. They're worrying about their jobs. They're worrying about their neighborhood. They've got a lot of other things on their plate. We're paid to worry about it.
Speaker John Boehner went before the cameras a little bit later on. He offered his take.
I want to do what I think is in the right the best interest of the country. But it takes two to tango, and they're not there yet.
It occurred to us that we've been hearing a whole lot from politicians lately, not much from real people.
I don't think that USA is never going to be able to get out of the debt that we're in right now.
The thing that I find most alarming is that we wait till the last minute in order to do these kind of things.
I'm concerned about what's going to happen so that we don't fall down our loans, but I'm also concerned about what we're going to do for the long term.
You want to talk about getting rid of the debt? Well, stop spending money. It's just like you and I. If we spend what we don't have, we go in debt, what happens? We got to go bankrupt, right?
That was Ruth Perez and Vel Perry in New York, John Thomas in St. Louis, and Lindsay Armin in Palo Alto, California on the debt limit today. I don't know if you do the Sunday talk show thing, but the Secretary of the Treasury was a big downer yesterday. Timothy Geithner was saying things we haven't really heard since the worst of the financial crisis, that the economy is going to be lousy for a long time to come, his words. And that makes a new report from the Federal Reserve all the more troubling, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Right now, Americans owe about $2.4 trillion in credit card debt, car loans, and tuition. But how can that be? Didn't we learn our lesson about borrowing being bad when the market crashed?
What we have here are really two economic recoveries.
Greg McBride is a financial analyst for Bankrate.com. He says there are two very different reasons for rising debt. Credit cards and banks are courting wealthy customers with new products and low interest rates. Others are borrowing because they have to.
Higher income households are really feeling a rebound in their financial portfolios. They're able to do a little bit more spending. Middle income households are really bearing the brunt of things like gasoline costs, higher food costs, and it's really squeezing their purchasing power.
To the extent they're using credit to buy the bare necessities. Ira Reingold is executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates.
Over the last couple of years, people really tried to save a little bit more. But I also think that with the economy not recovering, people are beginning to take out more credit simply to survive.
Stagnant wages haven't helped. MIT economist Michael Greenstone has been studying U.S. wage growth for the Brookings Institution. In a new report, he found that over the last three decades, wages for men have actually decreased.
Long-term wage stagnation or even wage declines have led people to borrow a lot. People got overextended, and I think it's making it difficult for consumers to experience real improvements in their standards of living.
High unemployment puts downward pressure on wages, and with food and gas prices rising, more Americans may have to count on plastic to get by. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. for Marketplace.
Debt and the limits thereof took a toll on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Every Wednesday at 3 o'clock, right after school, my kids have to do one of those things that falls under the general category of...
Okay.
You're going to do it because Mom and Dad said you're going to do it. An hour and a half of Chinese lessons. And yeah, part of that's just us. We speak Chinese. We've lived and worked there. Our daughter is Chinese. Part of it, though, is common sense. We're planning for their economic future. Because by the time they grow up... All right, already, China is driving the global economy. Whether, says China analyst Jim McGregor, it's ready for it or not.
If you look at the world economy as a Broadway musical, and all the countries are up dancing on the stage, and you've got America, Japan, and Europe dancing in the front, China was always dancing in back. And then one day, the global financial crisis happened, and China found itself dancing alone. Everybody else collapsed. And so China started thinking, well, maybe I do dance better than everybody else.
There's nothing quite like an international financial crisis to get you thinking about your place in the world.
And as China adds more and more people
to
its middle
China's class, progress as a threat.
The Chinese customer who's getting paid more these days.
So meanwhile, nations like China and India realized that with some changes of their own, they could compete in this new world.
From politicians to CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, China's on a lot of people's minds right now. It's been 5 years since we took the show there, trying to wrap our heads around the pace of change in that country and what that would mean for our shared economic fates. So this week, the sounds and voices of and about a China 5 years later.
The real estate bubble is going to bust, and it's unavoidable.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
Gentlemen,
don't fall down.
Welcome aboard high-speed CRH train.
The pockets of ordinary Chinese are swollen.
You keep trying to apply Western mentality to a Chinese equation. It doesn't work.
Nobody wants to come and explain it to me.
My dad's a telecom thingy. Computer engineer.
Yeah. And we train them and we train them and we train them, and now, of course, they're gone. Somebody will always pay them more.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm fine.
You are fine. Good.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
New bags, watch, clothes, shoes. Just look at
this.
We don't have too many choices. They choose us.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations, that's a hell of an achievement.
Our trip in 2006 to Shanghai on the coast in Chongqing, 900 miles out west in Sichuan province, was all about what happens when a country changes so much, so fast, the goods and the bads. Our trip back, one financial crisis and a global recession later, turns out to have been about the same thing, just with much higher stakes for the rest of us. So we'll go back to our Chinese future a little bit later on in the broadcast today and all the rest of this week. Before we get back to China, I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is that you're not going to be hearing Greek debt stories for a little while. Bad news is you're going to be hearing Italian debt stories instead. European Union leaders called yet another emergency meeting this morning to pressure a member country to pass an austerity budget. From London, Christopher Worth explains.
European officials have long worried that the debt crisis in Greece, Ireland, and Portugal would ultimately spread to Europe's larger economies like Spain and Italy. Luigi Zingales is with the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. He says Italy doesn't have deficit problems as big as Greece or Portugal, but it's weighed down with public debt, a staggering 120% of GDP.
Italy is in a major crisis of confidence.
Critics say that crisis was started by Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. He's trying to push out his respected finance minister, Giulio Tremonti, the main advocate of deep spending cuts in Italy. Zingales says the absence of Tremonti would be a problem.
A Berlusconi government without Tremonti will have no credibility in international financial markets.
He says because Italy faces increased borrowing costs, its deficit could rise still higher.
that is a spiral that becomes almost impossible to undo at a certain point, and I think we're coming pretty close to that point.
But Andrew Lillico of the consultancy Europe Economics says Italy's finances aren't in reality any worse than they were 6 months ago.
The real issue for Italy is just an unfortunate matter of timing.
Meaning Italy is trying to refinance around $250 billion worth of debt at a time when investors are jittery about the possibility of a eurozone default, a scenario, he says, that could bring Europe's contagion to the U.S. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The twists and turns continue in the saga of Rupert Murdoch and his British media empire. Today, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown said that he, too, had been hacked by the now closed News of the World. Murdoch has gone to London to try to clean up the mess and, in the process, salvage one of the biggest business deals of his career. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The speed of this crisis is breathtaking. A week ago, Britain's political leaders fell over themselves trying to win Murdoch's support. Now they're lining up to damn him and his plan to buy out Britain's biggest TV company, the hugely profitable B Sky B. Ed Miliband is leader of the opposition Labour Party.
As these allegations and new evidence emerges hour by hour, it makes more and more untenable the bid for B Sky B.
Murdoch wants to buy the 61% of B Sky B he doesn't already own, but his plan has been badly damaged by the phone hacking revelations and the claim today that his staff may have compromised the security of the royal family by buying their private contact details from a corrupt police officer. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg today had this message for Murdoch.
Look how the country has reacted with revulsion to the revelations. So do the decent and sensible thing. Think again about your bid for B Sky B.
Murdoch responded with some clever footwork. He withdrew certain concessions he'd made to allay monopoly concerns. Legally, the government would then have to turn the matter over to the independent competition regulator. In Parliament this afternoon, Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt did just that.
I am now going to refer this to the Competition Commission with immediate effect.
That removes the deal from the hostile political arena. Murdoch has bought himself time, but his troubles are far from over. A major police inquiry into the bribery claims is underway, and News Corp's share price is sinking. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, a visit to the Chinese past, present, and future. What's changed in the past 5 years?
They've now been wealthy for a while, and they're thinking about what is life all about as much as they are, how do I get rich really fast?
China, the five-year plan. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Europe, debt, Europe, you decide. The Dow Industrials fell 151 points today, 1.2%, ended at 12,505. The Nasdaq slumped 57 points, about 2%, 2802 at the bell. The S&P 500 slid 24 points, 1.8% there, finished at 1319. News Corp led the markets lower today, as Stephen Beard was telling us, printing a loss of more than 7.5% as that B Sky B deal began to look a whole lot shakier. Financials followed Citigroup down 5%, Goldman Sachs off 1.5%, AIG slid more than 3% today. Alcoa crumpled more than 2.75% in trading, that ahead of a disappointing earnings report from the aluminum giant, which came after the bell. Bond prices rose. When that happens, yields fall. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.92%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, managing more than $2 trillion in assets and providing investment solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. By Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
from the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for May. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee discusses manufacturing in the USA, training America's workforce. And Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner delivers opening remarks at a Women in Finance Investment Symposium. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The baseball All-Star Game is tomorrow. 49,000-some-odd fans are going to fill Chase Field in Phoenix to see baseball's best, or at least its most popular, if you like the voting system. That many people generate a whole lot of trash, but the park is armed with recycling bins, and the league does plan to compost most of what's left over. It's all part of a plan, as Eve Trow reports from the Sustainability Desk, to get the national pastime and some other sports, too, to go green.
A night game at Seattle's Safeco Field. Sounds like any other. But at the pregame show, the Mariners get an award from the state of Washington.
2011 Recycler of the Year Award.
Recyclers of the Year. And there to accept it?
Team members Captain Plastic and Kid Compost.
Captain Plastic and Kid Compost, two new Mariners mascots. They're the face of a behind-the-scenes push to green the game.
There's a better way to play here.
Scott Jenkins is vice president of ballpark operations. He's also a founding member of the Green Sports Alliance. It's a group of 30 pro teams, hockey to soccer, working with the Natural Resources Defense Council to shrink the environmental footprint of sports. Jenkins says, like any major industry, it's a big one.
We use a lot of water, we use a lot of energy, we create a lot of waste, we take planes.
He's tackling all that, from buying carbon offsets for the visiting team to pressing vendors for greener products. Like any good baseball fan, he loves stats.
Our electric is down 30%. Our water use is down 15%. We're currently at the 79% recycling rate of our waste.
He says the team saved $500,000 a year on power bills by doing simple things like swapping a scoreboard's old light bulbs for LEDs.
And that board alone, enough to power 100 homes for an entire year.
But there are some non-negotiables.
We have to water the grass. We have to cut it. We have to fertilize it.
AstroTurf's not likely to fly. It's thought to cause more player injuries. Jenkins likes to turn off the powerful park lights during day games. That can save more than $1,000. But
the quality of the game is first and foremost, and if the umpire says, I want the lights, or the manager wants the lights, we'll turn them on.
How do the fans feel? Some get confused. What were trash cans now only say composting or recycling. So what do you do with that empty beer cup?
I will be placing it in their recycling container.
Maybe it doesn't go in this one, it goes in that one.
Because this one says for bottles and cans. That's not a bottle or a can.
Jenkins says it's a learning process. The fans are a captive audience for green products and practices. Legendary sports agent Lee Steinberg agrees. He started his own Sporting Green Alliance.
You've got millions and millions of people that might otherwise never think about the environment, and all of a sudden it's a little bit glamorous, a little bit sexy, it's a little bit interesting. Sports can lead the way.
Especially if you get big names on board. Steinberg's seen athletes sway lots of social issues. So far, few players have voiced support or any opinion of environmental efforts. Steinberg's pushing his stars to take on the issue. He says it could also land them endorsement deals for green products. At Safeco Field, the Mariners push their own green product. No bobblehead doll this time.
I got a dirt bag. Would you like one?
Captain Plastic tosses 5-pound bags of Safeco soil into the arms of departing fans. It's made partly of trash composted after Mariners games. It stinks like manure. It
smells like awesome compost. I can't wait to put this in my pots.
Some people ask for 2 bags. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
Our series this week, the 5-year plan, takes us to China and the live broadcasts we did from there in 2006. We went back last month to see what's changed for them and for us.
The real estate bubble is then a bust.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in 2 generations.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
One of the things we kept saying to ourselves when we were in China last month was, hey, The Chinese, they're just like us. You got parents, like me, pushing their kids to learn the language. Because it's the smart thing to do. It turns out that about 7,000 miles and 15 time zones away, at just about the same time my kids were being tormented, a couple of Chinese kids were having almost the same experience learning English. Because their dad told them to. Just like us, they want a better life for their kids.
I hope their lives are better than ours. I hope they can make more money, have a better job than me. And I want them to go to university. I hope they can find a better employer, make money easier.
We'll meet Li Yongchin and his family a little bit later this week. But what better place to start our trip back to China than with a look at the future?
They're trying to race past a lot of years and look towards tomorrow because they can't look back.
Jim McGregor's been in China going on 25 years, first as a journalist, now as a businessman and an observer. We talked to Jim when we were here in 2006 about what China's amazing economic performance even then was going to mean for us. So when we decided to come back to see what's changed, we called him again and went out for a walk at a place called Tomorrow Square.
Even though it looks like a clock tower and a school, that was the British Race Club, and the stands were right behind it, and this whole Tomorrow Square area and what's west of it used to be the racetrack and the park.
That's where our hotel was, the Marriott at Tomorrow Square. Nice marketing, right? A futuristic hotel with a wraparound lobby up on the 38th floor. It is aspirational in the extreme. Kind of like the Ferrari dealership right next door. Oh, see, this is good. They've got Maseratis here, too. As I chat up the sales lady, who can't drive, by the way, I learned they sell 15 or so cars a year at $650,000 a piece, mostly to Chinese. Although she does tell me more people buy the Maserati because it's better for families.
No problem.
So as my walk with Jim McGregor continues, I ask him to square that picture of China with the one that most Americans have of this country.
Last time we spoke, you had a line that has stuck with me in the past 5 years. You know, it's an accident of history, you said, that these people are living in a communist society because they are the most daring and ambitious and cutthroat, I think you said, entrepreneurs and business people you will ever see. So you better be ready. You better bring your game.
Remember, these guys have been doing this for a couple thousand years. This is a country that came out of 150 bad years and is coming back. That's their view of the world. You know, they look at us as an accident of history. In one way, it's feeling like it's back, like they have really come through it and now they're on top of the world. On the other hand, they are still very insecure about their place, and they know what they have here is very fragile.
If you look around here, you see unbelievable, the second tallest building in the world, you can see from where we're standing. You see an unbelievably modern subway system that works and is clean. I mean, we've been riding it for 2 weeks, and it's great. How can they be insecure? How can they be nervous?
Well, because I think they know at the core the contradictions that they are living with. You know, it's run by a communist party that has modern planning. You know, it's kind of like part GE and part the mafia.
Let's stop for a minute in front of the Park Hotel here, this amazing Art Deco building that faces Tomorrow Square. It faces the old racing club.
All these folks walking by, those who aren't staring at us doing a radio interview, and as they go about their daily lives, which are, you know, life is life is life, are they thinking about their place in the Chinese economy and China's place in the global economy?
You know, I think people here are just starting to think. They have been on a treadmill. They all came from nothing, and it is a very competitive society, and now they're starting to think about quality of life. They're thinking about work-life balance. They're thinking about their health. You know, psychology has all of a sudden come alive here, and people are going to counselors, and they're now been wealthy for a while, and they're thinking about what is life all about as much as they are how do I get rich really fast.
Before anybody gets rich, there is business to tend to. 5 years ago, right up the road from where McGregor and I are walking, there used to be a great little dumpling place.
Anyhow,
I went back to try to find it again. Of course, it was gone. Now it's a hot pot restaurant. Scorpion Sheep Hot Pot, the boss says, famous all over the country. It was a pure business decision, she tells me. Changing menus in a changing market. Even from 5 years ago, it just seems to me that there are a lot more foreigners here, you know, and that it's not special almost being a foreigner in China who knows their way around.
You know what? That is a profound change, and I think it's unsettled a lot of the longtime foreign community, and it's also changed the way they treat foreign business. I was at a dinner the other night with six China hands, all been here 25 to 30 years. Some of them were people who could see no wrong in China for many of those years. They really drank the Kool-Aid. And to a person, they're worried sick about this place right now, because that's the big question. How does it last? Because of these contradictions we're talking about.
When we were here 5 years ago, you could see that China was a work in progress. Physically, first of all. In Shanghai, there were construction cranes all over the place. Now, you stand on the riverfront and look out to the new section of the city. It could be Hong Kong for all the neon and steel and glass towers. But there's a mental aspect, too. People are ready. They're ready for consumerism and middle-class wages and a better life. So tomorrow, what we found when we went looking for that better life. You can hear and read and see more about our trip to China. We've got pictures and videos at our website. It's marketplace.org. Send us your thoughts while you're there as well.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at progressive.com. By FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a slice of Chinese life as just a taste of what's to come in our series this week. Taxi fares in Shanghai went up last Friday. Not a whole bunch, just 2 yuan, about 30 cents or so to drop the flag. A modest sign of inflation. My advice, if you're in Shanghai, by the way, take the subway. It's fab. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow down 151 points, 1.2%. Debt worries Europe. You decide. The NASDAQ down 57 points, 2%. The S&P 500 off 24 points, 1.8%. Our producers include Avshai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, the Chinese economy, as you know, has been growing like gangbusters. So business owners, oh, they have great expectations.
In the future, all women who buy the things in the internet will be our customer.
You're sure of that?
I'm sure of that.
Unbridled optimism tomorrow on the 5-year plan. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for it. This is APM, American Public Media.